This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to the Evening Edition. I'm Caroline Owen. Today, we are going to be exploring a very interesting topic, the topic of women in technology. And we're going to follow the journey of a pretty incredible woman. She's been apparently in Silicon Valley since 1993. Now, that's before Silicon Valley was the Silicon Valley that we know it to be today. She's worked with some of the biggest names, Juniper Networks, Symantec. She was also a mentor at Tech Women. That's a U.S. Department of State initiative. And today, she serves on the board of Fast Forward. That's an accelerator for tech nonprofits based in San Francisco. She goes around the world working and inspiring women to join the industry. Her name is Rekha Pai Kamath. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Caroline.
It's very good to have you here with us. Now, I managed to watch, I think a couple of the talks that you've done, and you know they're floating around YouTube. They're all there on the internet, and I understand that, I mean, your resume is really impressive. So what I just said was sort of cherry picking what I thought was really great from there. But from what I understand, it came from a love of fractals. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. All right. I'll let you tell that story. How did this love for technology begin for you?
Well, at the very beginning, when I was in middle school, I was already interested in science, but we had a wonderful TV program. It was called Cosmos. It was by Carl Sagan. And that TV program opened my world up to astrophysics and astronomy. And I used to watch that program with a lot of interest every Sunday. And that really changed my mind. It inspired me to work in the field of astrophysics or astronomy. So I wanted to work, like that was my dream, to work in space.
I imagine that a lot of people would have watched Cosmos, right? A huge program. And yet they're not where you are today. Do you think one needs to be naturally inclined to, I suppose, technology in general? Or, what is it exactly?
I think it's all about going with the flow and going with your interests and passions, following your interests and passions. And that changed over the years. So I did want to work in astrophysics, but then I found new interests over the years. When I was in engineering school, I did PCB design and electronics and microprocessors, and that led to computer engineering, which I ended up doing.
Right. Okay, so let's go along that journey for a little bit. So in these videos that I've watched, you told the story of first impressions. That was a story to me. And of you visiting a doctor perhaps for the first time. Share that story with us.
Oh, when I was in 11th grade, that's what, like junior high, I felt sick. I had, I think, a really bad case of pneumonia or something like that. And I was in India. And at that time, I had never visited a hospital before that in my life. But my mom took me to a small clinic. It was very close to our house. And I visited this clinic, and it was the first time for me in a doctor's office. She was practicing by herself. She was very pregnant. And so I walk into this room. The walls are full of lined paperwork. It was a dark, dingy room, a lot of paperwork everywhere. She checked me out, and then I went home with my treatment. But that whole thing led me, and she was very uncomfortable because she was pregnant, and I felt sorry for her. But the whole experience left me with, if this is what a doctor does, I don't want to be a doctor.
Yeah.
So what I forgot to mention right now is, right before this, I had to make a decision of whether I had to take physics, chemistry, math, or physics, chemistry, bio. That was the decision that I was supposed to take.
Was that how the schools are structured?
Yeah. Yes. Right.
Right. And so tell us about that decision. I mean, so 10th grade, how old would you have been at the time we go?
16.
So you're sort of making these, and they're life-changing decisions that you're expected to make at that time. But was it a huge decision to you at the time? I mean, did you know what you were doing when you decided, this is what I'm going to do?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I really don't think so. At that point, you're 16.
Yeah.
How much of the world have you seen, right? You've not... seen that much. And my first exposure to medicine or to the whole medical field was a small clinic privately run by one person, and she was uncomfortable while doing her job. Mm-hmm. She might have been really good at doing her job, but she was in this one clinic and not a glamorous hospital, not a lighted place, not a place that I might want to work. Mm-hmm. So that was my first interaction with doctors, and I think that left me with an impression of this career is not for me. And I would say that that was not a very informed choice. So my point would be, I would really like to see kids who are in school, who are in high school, really expose themselves to different career, make informed choices, and not make the first impression guide you. Because I've seen a lot of kids in the Silicon Valley tell me this. I don't want to become an engineer because my father or mother is on the computer all day, and that's not what I want to do.
Right.
But they don't realize that it's a lot more than that. Like, when I visited that dingy place, I didn't realize that the doctor might have been feeling very fulfilled at treating me or somebody like me. So it could be very fulfilling for her, but mm-hmm. I couldn't have seen that walking into that office. So we all make judgments. I think kids make them too. They want to go to a career that's fun, or what they perceive as fun, or what they perceive as right. And yeah. the world is telling them what to do. And it's a very impressionable age. So I would say to all of them, don't make your first impression be your guide.
Yeah. You know, I think here in Malaysia, we're seeing a little bit of a shift where, so it's always been a big thing, right? Parents, or traditional, conventional Asian parents, or, you know, you be a lawyer, you be a doctor, you be an accountant. And so it's only been in recent years that you've seen this shift where a lot of kids are going towards the arts, you know, because it's sexy to do that. You want to be an actor, you want to be a singer, you want the glamour and all the rest of it. But in your instance, it's a sort of a pushback to where we've come from. So what would you say to kids who are making this decision right now, you know, that would make it look like a sexier decision than, you know, to go into broadcasting, to go into acting and the rest of it?
Yeah, I think the main thing I would tell them is follow your passions. Yes, there's a place for passions in your career. It's very fulfilling to do something for a job, something that you really like in your life. Follow your passions is a big advice that I would give, because without passion, you wouldn't be able to excel at your job or try really hard. But at the same time, there are some realities with some professions where it's difficult to find fulfillment. And the other thing I would like to say is that success actually creates the confidence. When you are successful, when you practice hard at something, when you're successful at a career or any aspect of education, even that actually inspires you or pushes you to do better at what you're already good at. So I would say consider every career choice very carefully, and look at all aspects, find out, ask questions, talk to people in that career, find out what the pluses and minuses and trade-offs are, and if you're really passionate about it, go for it.
That's Rekha Pai Kamath. Now, just in a little bit, we'll be talking about the cultural factors that influence young people's interest in STEM careers. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is the Evening Edition with me, Caroline Oh, and today I've been speaking with Rekha Pai Kamath, who's had a lot of experience in the tech industry. She's worked for big names like Juniper Networks, Symantec, and Applied Materials. She's also a mentor who supports other entrepreneurs and women in tech fields. Today, Rekha shares her story.
Would you say that you had sort of an enabling environment? Did you grow up in one? Because from what I understand, your father moved around a lot and you had to move around with him. I mean, was it difficult for you to allow you to do what you do today?
Yes, it was difficult leaving my friends, but I really believe that there was a good aspect to it, where I learned to make friends easily, to adapt new situations. So when I moved to the US for either my studies or to a different state inside the US to work, I could easily adapt, and that actually gave me an advantage, I feel. So every event in your life has something positive to it. That's what, there's always a learning outcome if there's not anything else.
Yeah. How did the education system help you?
Growing up?
Yeah. I guess in encouraging you to pursue your interests.
Growing up, I didn't have a lot of role models for what I wanted to do. So that part was actually quite lacking. I didn't know a lot of women engineers. In fact, I didn't know any woman engineer. Carl Sagan was a big role model for me.
And I understand the astronaut as well, the first Indian astronaut.
Yes, the Rakesh Sharma. So I think when you're a kid in high school, if you allow yourself to let your curiosity direct you, you can get really passionate about certain domains or aspect, and that's fine, because that's you're showing your individuality by pursuing those passions. And the education system in India is very traditional, and it depends on how you do in the competitive exams. And the focus of education is very big too. I believe that's really helped me, you know, achieve whatever I did.
For sure. Were there many women in engineering at the time that you decided to take a degree? Because, you know, I'm just thinking back maybe 20 years ago, you know, the engineering faculty in Sheffield, it was like little Chinatown to begin with, and there were hardly any women. So what was it like for you?
Well, in India, it was six of us in a class of 60. So that's 10%. And, you know, it was not easy in some senses, because you don't really know what's going on and information is not all out there. So you have to be a little more aggressive at finding out what's going on. But we learned to survive, and we kept together. The culture is also such that there's not that much of mingling between women and boys at that age, I think. Although I had very good friends who then did projects with me. So it was a very professional kind of it was supportive, I would say. Right. But in the US, of course, the work environment is much more supportive in the sense, at least where I work, there is a big focus on sharing and collaboration and mentorship.
And I imagine that really allowed you to, get further ahead, because you're mingling with the community a lot more and you're sharing a lot of that information. So tell us what happened. I mean, we're continuing along that journey. Just tell us what happened when you first started work, when you finished your degree.
Yeah. I joined SGI in 93, and I was really doing the job that I dreamed of, building parallel computers, building the chips for the parallel computers.
So your dream was to build chips for computers?
For parallel computers, for supercomputers.
How specific,
yes.
Okay.
Chips is microprocessors.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. So that was actually, I had my dream job. I wasn't a dream, I mean, at that time, Clinton had just visited us. I think it was the second week of my joining that Clinton came over and joined us. And it was what Google is today. So SGI was the company to work for at that time. So it was a wonderful experience. I was working with coworkers who were smart and brilliant. I was learning from them, exchanging, building, you know, this floating point unit inside a microprocessor. So it's very intellectually stimulating. It was a great learning environment, very supportive. And I was young. I had a lot of some time to pursue my other interests, so I did. And it was a nice experience.
Right. So considering that was your dream job, you moved on. Where did you go and why did you move? If you're in your dream job, right?
Yeah. I stayed on at SGI until 1998, until MIPS Technologies, the subdivision inside which I was working at SGI, it spun off into a separate company. So I stayed on with MIPS till 2001.
Right.
So I didn't really leave that until, of course, I had my green card process
Yeah. And did you see a change by way of, I suppose, just demographics? Were you seeing a lot more women joining in the time that you were there? Just a lot more participation?
Yeah. If we look at it now, I think there's a lot more participation. Back then, there were still kind of not that many women. Although in my smaller group, I would say the woman who hired me was a Iowa State alum, and she had come to Iowa State to interview me, and so she was my mentor and role model. So yes, we did have a couple of women. One of my managers was a woman, so I did have some women in my team. But from the larger group, as a ratio, I would say that it was not very high.
Yeah. I mean, that's the criticism even today, right? We're saying there's just not enough women in technology. You know, I'm sure it has nothing to do with capability or capacity. You know, anyone can do anything that they want to. Why do you think that is? So when you were in that environment at that point in time, and it was just a few of you, you hardly had any, you know, female colleagues, what stopped them from being in the industry?
I think back then, the number of grads in electrical engineering and computer engineering were lower. Hmm. But that's not the case in maybe now. Yeah. I mean, now I see industry graduates graduating out of Stanford and Iowa State, even much higher percentages of college grads are women. But at that time, I think for at master's level, there were just fewer women.
Yeah. And now with more women, that's still the same case. We still don't have enough women in technology. What do you think the barriers to entry are?
That's a good question. I think it starts very young. In middle school, I find kids saying, I'm not good at math. I mean, yeah. I don't, when I hear that, I ask them, why do you think you're not good at math? And I think it's a perception, or they feel that they're better at something else rather than math. So right. I find that, at least in the US, I find that kids quickly label themselves as one or the other. And I think that the drop-off happens even much younger, like even before high school. So there's a critical place where in fourth or fifth grade, if you don't master some math skills, you find yourself less confident about math, I feel. That's why in middle school, I feel like we really need to help our girls, feel much more confident about math and science and do hands-on projects and see the effects of coding or even engineering or science applied to real life, right?
How is that playing out by way of education? So people dropping off at a certain age, right? So we're looking at a critical window where you must, I suppose, master some skills is what you were saying. So what is being done now?
Done about
yeah.
it. Well, in the U.S., I'm seeing a lot more focus on STEM in girls, but that's happening more in the high school age group. In middle school, I think it's happening more at the family level or the school level where yeah. they want all, at least in California, you know, we want all kids to attain a certain level of math education. And I think that's across boys and girls, but I think for girls, there is a cultural barrier, and I think that comes more from media and outside, something outside telling them, you're not supposed to be that good at math.
You think? Still?
I mean, or either that or they're telling themselves that they're not good at math, and I don't know the psychological reason why.
For sure. And since you've been in it for a while now, have you seen more of an uptake of, you know, girls and women being interested in, you know, being in technology?
Yeah, I'm seeing, at least in the Silicon Valley, I'm seeing, you know, programs held for programming, Girls Who Code and Technovation Challenge. Girls are taking up programming and especially coding, I would say. Yeah. I wouldn't say that about engineering.
Yeah.
I mean, there will always be kids or girls who self-select themselves and saying, I'm an engineer, I know I'm an engineer, and that this is
I
what I'm going to do.
I love fractals and cell towers and all of that.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. And that's fine. Yeah. But there's a lot more, I think there are a lot more kids who could say, I can do it. You know, it doesn't have to be the hard math or I don't have to be this Einstein to be an engineer, right?
Yeah.
So that perception barrier is what I'm seeing happen. And I keep asking these middle schoolers, why do you think you're not good at math? And I think there's some kind of a perception barrier that makes them either falter at the critical stage, fourth, fifth grade, sixth grade.
For sure. All right. Perhaps talk to us about what you're currently doing. So I said this a little earlier, you're a board member at Fast Forward, which accelerates tech nonprofits by investing money, providing training, all of that. You know, tell us a bit more about what you do.
I'm on the board of a tech nonprofit accelerator. It's an accelerator for tech nonprofit. Actually, it's the only one. It's like a YC, if you've heard of a Y Combinator. Have you heard of a Y Combinator?
No, I haven't.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's an accelerator for-profit world. That's in San Francisco. It's the largest one. But Fast Forward is an accelerator for tech nonprofits. And so what we do is help tech companies who want to provide social impact for underserved or underrepresented communities through a tech platform. So they have to be a nonprofit that's using technology as a platform, leveraging technology in a key way to deliver products or services to the underserved or the underrepresented.
Do you like what you do now?
Yes.
Yeah?
I love it.
I think, and I'm going back to this talk that I saw you do, you talked about, you know, just using all the knowledge that you have and connecting it with communities to be able to help people. Do you feel that this is what you're doing? It certainly sounds like it is.
Yeah. I mean, more than me, there are 23 companies that went through our accelerator who are all doing amazing things with their with technology to deliver real impact. They've impacted 18 million people as of now, and the 23 companies that went through our program raised 28 million of follow-on funding. So it's a lot of progress. We have a lot of corporate partners, a lot of sponsorships. Google.org is a big sponsor, BlackRock, Omidia Network. So we were able to raise a lot of money. But we're seeing a lot of startups do this, especially in San Francisco area, where they want to really create social impact. And technology is the right way to do it because it enables unlocking value much more easily, but because it makes things cheaper to run, it makes it frictionless, right? Mm-hmm. If you wanted to build a platform that connects demand and supply, if you wanted to build a platform, for example, that connects poorer people in the community who need certain drugs and clinics who have unused, unexpired drugs sitting around, then you use a tech platform to connect the two parties and make that impact happen.
I'm speaking with Rekha Pai Kamath. Now, in just a bit, we're going to be talking about Rekha's role as a mentor to other women in tech fields. Stay tuned. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
This is the Evening Edition. I'm Caroline Oh. My guest today is Rekha Pai Kamath. Now, Rekha, having set foot in Silicon Valley in 1993, has had over two decades of experience in the tech industry. Now, she's a board member of Fast Forward, which is an accelerator for tech nonprofits based in San Francisco. She also mentors other emerging women tech leaders under Tech Women. Now, that is a U.S. Department of State initiative that connects global women leaders in technology with those in Silicon Valley. As she's with us today to share her experience. I also wanted to talk about tech women for a bit. I mentioned that right at the beginning where you mentored women from many different countries. What observations do you have, you know, of these different women that you've mentored across the world?
It has been a tremendous experience for me being part of the Tech Women program, being a mentor. I have done that for 5 years. This would be my sixth year. And I've been to three countries as part of delegation trips, Rwanda, Tunisia, and Kazakhstan. And it's always amazing to me how the women come to the Bay Area. We call them emerging leaders. And they come, and once they finish the program, they become fellows. Mm. They become Tech Women fellows. So these emerging leaders come to the Bay Area wanting to learn and share. And it's always amazing to me how much I learn from them, how much we learn, and how much we get through that in enrichment exercise, right? I think we both learn from each other just through sharing our lives and work and our experiences. There's a lot of mentoring happening, but there's a lot of, you know, exchange of relationships being formed, you know, where we try to keep in touch with their efforts even after the program gets over. Mm-hmm. After the program gets over, they return to their home countries, and we try, while they're in the Bay Area, we guide them through their action plans, which is sort of like impact projects that they're supposed to go back to their countries and execute. And so we follow up with their action plans, and I've seen amazing results come out. My emerging leader from Kenya, her name is Josephine Kamante, and she was already half of an entrepreneur when she came to be mentored at Juniper. But she went back and she has this project to build solar power computer classrooms for every rural school in Kenya.
Oh, wow.
So there are 50 schools in rural Kenya that got funded. She raised the funding for it and she executed on building solar powered computer classrooms for all the rural villages in Kenya.
That's incredible.
So that's a very inspiring story. When you're part of that, like I would, you know, that's why we mentors mentor, is because we want to be part of those kind of stories.
That's an amazing story. You know, I like it. I like it a lot when say, you know, you mentioned a little earlier, you got to learn so much. So I like it when that sharing comes, you know, it does a 360. Perhaps you can share with us, you know, something unique that you learned from mentoring these young emerging leaders, right?
Yeah. Well, I learned how vibrant the rest of the world is. And that's actually why I'm here too in Malaysia. It's like I go to all these places, I see a dynamic, vibrant community of entrepreneurs, women who want to do amazing things with their worlds. And I come back feeling inspired. So for me, that, I mean, the reason I do all these exchanges, come talk here, meet with these entrepreneurs, is to feel inspired by what people do. Yesterday I have to mention this. Yesterday I met a little girl. She's in middle school. She participated in Technovation Challenge, which is another program that I'm intimately involved with. It's a mobile app pitch competition for high school and middle school girls. And there's a chapter here in Malaysia. I think three or four entries went. Alicia is the girl that I met yesterday, won the semifinals from Malaysia, and she's been invited to go to the Technovation Challenge pitch event, the worldwide pitch event in San Francisco in August. So Technovation Challenge is this mobile app and pitch competition that's open to every middle school and high school girl all over the world. Mm-hmm. 78 countries have participated till now. About 1,500 or maybe it's 3,000. I forget the number, but it's a huge number of girls who participate. And every year we have regional competitions all over the world. I've actually judged also entries from Nigeria and Pakistan and stuff. But We all have regional competitions. I think Malaysia and Southeast Asia was one region. Mm-hmm. And the regional competition winners get invited for the global pitch event that happens in San Francisco every year. So I met Alicia and the experience was really amazing to me. I was very inspired by how clearly she thought about her problem. And her app was about crowdsourced reporting of dirty restaurants. Like rats. Apparently there are restaurants here that are not kept hygienic and clean.
Apparently, it's true. It's true, I have to say. It keeps the food tasty. Go on.
Yeah, but she has an app where people can report, self-report. If you go to a restaurant and you notice that it's unhygienic, you can report it. So it's a crowdsourced reporting app for unhygienic restaurants.
So these women that you work with in all the different communities that you've seen, you know, in your mentorship process, do they generally come from a supportive, enabling environment, would you say?
Yes, that's one thing I've noticed is that, I mean, the women who come is on the higher level of education in their countries. They've achieved something already. They have very supportive families and supportive environments. I mean, there could be occasionally some women who don't, but they overcome these challenges.
Yeah.
I've seen them overcome that.
What do you think, by way of support, what kind of support do you think needs to be provided for developing countries so that, you know, there are more women in technology?
I think the first and foremost, I think we need to have, at a policy level, we need to have policy that dictates that we need to support women in technology or any... first of all, there needs to be a culture of supportiveness for the women in the workplace also. So equal pay for equal work, gender equity, all these aspects help women in the workplace and their jobs. So for developing countries like Malaysia, I think what would help is, you know, again, policies, culture, mentoring events, role models, availability of role models. So if I would say events that highlight stories of professional accomplishments by women, events that highlight radio shows, maybe that highlight entrepreneurs, women entrepreneurs who have overcome barriers and, you know, done something and speak about their experiences, all availability of role models is a big thing, I think.
At any point, Rekha, along your career, have you come up against any sort of barriers or challenges because you're a woman?
Yeah, absolutely. The first occasion happened when I wanted to go to the US to do my master's, and my mom and dad were like not very supportive of it, specifically my dad, because in India, it's not a very, you know, at a certain age, a younger age, to go so far away. It was not...
Not the done thing.
Yeah, it was not the done thing. They were worried about me.
Right.
So, but I had to convince them, and I talked to them, and they had trust and faith in me, which is why I was able to do it. In the US, I think it's a tricky balance as a woman. You know, you have to... I have a 17-year-old, so for me to be able to manage the work-life balance and run at the fast pace that a startup or a fast-paced tech company work demands, you have to outsource a lot. And there are some tricks and techniques that I've learned over my life to manage the barriers and overcome them.
Can you share them with us? Maybe a couple.
Yeah, I would tell all women, if you're working and you find it hard, outsource the heck out of the home and keep your precious family time with the kids.
Outsource the heck out of your home. I really like that. I think it's nice. Would you say there's still a glass ceiling for women in technology?
Yes. Yes and no. We're trying to get there. But yes, there's... I feel that in some areas, like at least in the Silicon Valley, we're trying to break through the glass ceiling. Specifically in Juniper, I'd say. Like, I'm sad to see so many women in the exec offices sometimes just leave because the environment was difficult. I mean, sometimes the reasons are political also.
Right, sure.
But I see women leave. And it's very rare. I mean, there are women who stay and go up the ladder, but... There are enough number of women who leave also.
Right. What are the primary reasons for leaving?
The team, supportiveness of the team.
Right.
Yeah. But although I have to say at Juniper, I've had a lot of support within my team for myself. But there are teams that not necessarily have them.
Yeah. Okay, Rekha. So for somebody who's achieved as much as you have, who's, you know, done so much, I have to ask, what's next for you? Where do you go from here?
So I'm on the board of Fast Forward, the Accelerator for Tech Nonprofits, and I want to learn. I've spent my time over the last 2 years understanding the nonprofit space and tech nonprofit space. I really am passionate about it. I go to a lot of events in the Valley. I go to Stanford, Berkeley. I'm learning about how AI can be used, you know, responsibly, how machine learning and different technologies can be used responsibly to deliver impact. We are going... I think the world is moving to an increasingly automated world, right? We are going to have automated cities, cars.
We're going to have chips in our brains.
I don't think so. Not that much. But we're moving towards a much more automated society. And that's going to lead to a lot of people being disenfranchised. Many people are going to lose their jobs. Plus... when we create these AI, artificial intelligence and machine learning, when we use these technologies, I just want to make sure that we're using them with all parties in the equation, like, you know, using diversity in mind. So if it's all about using technology responsibly, but it's not going to just get there. You know, right now, the people who are developing these AI algorithms or the people who are giving the data to feed these learning algorithms are not all diverse, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you give bad data to a technology, an algorithm, then it'll come out with prejudices and biases. So we don't want that. And so for me, I want to know how to use technology really responsibly so that we really do the right thing for the community as a whole.
Right. So it's participation across the board. Get yourself to the table and let your voice be heard, essentially.
Rekha
Paikama, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Rekha Paikamath, board member at Fast Forward in San Francisco and a mentor for entrepreneurs and women in technology. In just a bit, we're going to be hearing from Alicia and Adinda, the creators of the Citizen app. And that's what Rekha was just talking about. Don't go anywhere. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bring forth Moolah, BFM 89.9.
This is the Evening Edition. I'm Caroline O. Right now, we're going to be hearing from Adinda Nurul Fadia Asfar and Alicia Sashvina Nair Suresh.
Hi, my name's Alicia.
Hi, my name is Adinda.
Now, they're representing Malaysia as semi-finalists of the Technovation Challenge 2017. And they're going to be attending the World Pitch event that's happening on the 7th of August in Santa Clara in the US. They're with us today to talk about the app that they made, the Citizen app, and how it could change our eating experiences.
So KL is a very big city. There are over 150,000 eateries and restaurants in KL itself. There's no way that all of these 150,000 eateries are clean. So there's a very big concern on public health. And also most people, when you look at a dirty eatery, that always translates into the image of the country. So what we didn't want that just one unclean eatery to be the image of the country being like, oh, this country is dirty, we don't want to visit it anymore. So that was like the problem we were trying to address during ideation process.
Yeah. So the main point was when we first started to realize that Malaysia as a whole, the eateries itself, sometimes everybody has experienced this at least once. You go to a local mama store and then you find it very an unpleasing environment, and it's kind of stuck into us as Malaysians or people who live in the society right now. It's kind of with us now. So let's say we go to a restaurant right now and we see this very unhygienic area or environment. We don't do much about it, so that's the problem that we're trying to
address. Currently, we think like, oh, we see a dirty environment. We feel like we can't do much about it. So we want to change that perspective, saying, oh, you can do something about it. Because every time you go into a dirty place, you leave with complaints. You have to leave with complaints. And they go unheard of. So what if we could translate those complaints, make it a report, simple report, and that way we actually have actionable data that can be taken action on by the local authorities.
The Citizen app works through a crowdsourcing method to compile and update information about the hygiene status of eateries.
It's a very simple app. So you enter a report, like a very simple report, take a quick picture, tag a location, and this can be, and of course, the complaint. Like we have four categories, simple categories that they are just an overall
on the complaints.
Based on the complaints, and then you can enter them, and then which can be queried later on. There's something that can be used later on by local authorities or even by customers if they want to know, oh, is my eatery clean? Do I want to know whether this place is clean or not? They can always refer back to the complaint someone else has sent or someone or even they have issued, you know, into the app. People look at Citizen currently as a negative approach, being where you scrutinize on what people have done or the environment. So one thing we are discussing is to promote a positive approach, saying where, let's say, assume you complain about this restaurant. If the restaurant would like to take time to clean up the place, to fix what was wrong, and then advertise it, so saying, okay, look, I've cleaned this place up now, you guys can come back, and for them to withdraw their complaints, saying, yeah, they have cleaned it up, I highly recommend this place, because they do take action on what has been said by the public.
Yeah, so it's a win-win kind of situation. Yeah. We started off from scratch, basically. And as we moved forward, we changed a lot of our original ideas.
We had two ideas initially, which were, of course, citizen. And we had another idea, which was for open burning and like natural disasters and like flash floods or things that affect the environment. We did a survey and we found out Malaysians don't really care. They care more about their personal hygiene than they care about the environment, because that doesn't have an immediate effect on them. But where else, if you eat something gross, you'll end up having an immediate effect, you'll fall sick. But if you smell smoke, you don't really know what's actually going on in your body.
There's not much you can do, even if you knew what was going on. Like, let's say there was an actual fire going on. You can't go by yourself and get a bucket of water and start trying to save the forest. So we decided to take a more subtle idea, which is
A more targeted idea.
Something
that's very straightforward rather than something that's very generic, very open. Coding was done mainly by me and Adinda. We did coding from scratch. We had to learn from YouTube. A lot of it we learned from YouTube.
A lot, yeah.
There was this simple 3 courses which we took, which were given by Technovation, which were like very simple courses, just the basic ideas. But it didn't cover a lot that we needed. So we had to look into YouTube. We had to ask each other. Sometimes we had to create our own codes. So it was pretty hard to code. I said coding was probably the hardest phase of the whole challenge.
That was Adinda Nurofadia Asfar and Elisha Sajrina Nair Suresh, semi-finalists of the Technovation Challenge 2017. And if you missed any part of this program, you can download the podcast on our BFM app. Of course, it's available on the Apple App Store and also on Google Play. It's Caroline O on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.